Welcome back to Remember What's Next, Season 3. This is the podcast where we explore the intersection of Jewish history and modern-day challenges. I'm Ellie Bass, a Jewish educator, healer, and coach, and joining me once again is Rabbi Ken Spiro. He's an author, educator, and world-renowned Israel tour guide and historical pundit. In this season, we'll be examining the vital importance of Jewish unity. Throughout history, the Jewish people have faced countless obstacles and challenges, yet have always managed to survive and thrive due to their unity and sense of collective purpose when we can muster it. We'll examine the clashes and collaborations between ancient traditions and modern innovations and explore how these interactions can shape a better future for everyone. We're jumping into the unique challenges and opportunities facing the Jewish community in the modern era, and how our unity can help us confront these challenges and build a brighter future for all. So join us on this journey of discussion, learning, and inspiration as we remember the past, discover the present, and explore what's next for the Jewish people.
Welcome back, everyone. Welcome back, Rabbi Ken Spiro.
Good to be back.
Nice to see you live from Jerusalem. So I think we're going to start this episode again. We're going to do an update from Israel. We would love to hear what's happening there on the ground. We're going to offer our unique perspective in terms of the historical context and the spiritual context of what's happening as best we can. And then we're going to speak a little bit about what's going on also in the diaspora, in the Jewish world, and how do we understand this in terms of history to be able to understand how to hold what's going on now. So do you want to give us a bit of an update? Tell us what's happening, and I would love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, so we're, you know, the initial shock in Israel is like, people are still in shock, but it's the initial shock has definitely passed. You just feel the energy on the street. And, you know, the first few days, everything was closed and no one was around anywhere. And now there's a lot more people on the streets. It's still very empty, like all the restaurants and places of entertainment. No one's going out and doing anything like that. Wow. But life is sort of, Israelis are very resilient, and we've been there and done this so many times already. So things are kind of sort of returning to a little bit of normalcy. But of course, everyone is expecting what hasn't happened yet, which everyone thought would have happened already by last week, which is the real war starting. Now it's just, you know, the scenario we've had until now for most times is just the Air Force goes in and blows a lot of stuff up. But now we're waiting for that massive ground invasion because everyone recognizes that there's no middle ground here. This is not one of those we blow them up for a week or 2 weeks and then we reach some sort of ceasefire agreement. Combination of the level of brutality and slaughter, like everyone's calling it. It's like, this is like 29/11s for Israel in one day.
Yeah.
Combined with the fact that they're holding on to, we're not even sure, several hundred hostages. No one is going to repeat. And the devastation, little devastation, whole communities, you know, like Kfar Aza are just destroyed, completely destroyed.
Yeah.
You know, no one, there's not a chance that anyone is going to move back into any of these places again. I don't blame them unless there's no more Hamas. It's not a matter of degrading Hamas. It's a matter of ending Hamas. And you listen to like the commander in chief of the army, a defense minister. He just says openly, every single person who was involved in attacking us is dead. He said, it may take a year. It may take years. We're going to hunt you down and we're going to kill you all.
Right.
So, and it's not a matter of revenge. It's a matter of justice with a difference. You know, this cannot be allowed to go on. So obviously when the ground war begins and everyone knows this is going to be really difficult, you know, obviously just as Hamas prepared meticulously for an attack that succeeded beyond their wildest imagination, they have no doubt dug themselves in. I mean, I had two of my kids were combat medics, one in the paratroopers and one in the Golani Brigade. And one was in 2008, 2009, and one was in 2014. And back then, especially I remember in 2014, they were all screaming, you know, come down and fight us like men, you know, stop like just shooting us with planes. And then the army goes in and they all run and hide.
Right.
So there were some casualties, but there really was no showdown. But this is a fight to the death. So just as we're going to fight because it's our existential, you know, our existence is being threatened here. This is it for them. They're not going anywhere. Egypt's not going to let them all flee into the Sinai. So they got their backs to the sea, and they're not. And they, as they say openly, they love death. They glorify it. They look forward to it. well, Jews love life, they say. We love death. We want to be martyred.
Right. And look, again, we're talking about Hamas. Like, I'm sure there are, you know, civilians also who aren't necessarily in that headspace, but, you know, it's very hard talking about women and children on anywhere where, you know, we know that people are going to die and their own people are not going to protect them. And I think that that's also really heartbreaking. Yeah. You know, I think the same way that Golda Meir said, you know, we can forgive them for killing our kids, but we can't forgive them for making us kill theirs. I just think it's a really heartbreaking situation for people on so many levels. And this isn't an equivocation. This is just saying the way that this is set up, people are going to be killed, and it's brutal and not something we should be happy about on any level.
No, of course, but you have to remember also that Hamas was elected by the population of Gaza, and the majority of them, I'm not saying they deserve to be slaughtered, don't get me wrong, but the majority of the population of Gaza, despite the fact that all the money that's been directed towards them has been, you know, basically redirected towards bunkers and bombs and missiles, including all the pipes for the irrigation and the sewage turned into missiles that misfire and land on hospitals and things like that.
Yep.
But so there's a certain level of collective accountability for what the situation they have. But on the other hand, Israel has gone out of its way and given them, you know, 10, 11 days to head south and get out of the fighting.
Right.
And Hamas, we know, is they you know, the best way they sum it up is we use our missiles to protect our civilian population, and Hamas uses its civilian population to protect its missiles.
Yeah.
So, it's going to be a terrible situation. And when you're dealing with people who have no care for life, not their own lives or their lives, or certainly the people they're supposedly representing.
Right.
I'm afraid is what's going to be. I'm afraid it's going to be very difficult fighting. Mm. And it's going to be, I hope not, but it could be significant casualties on our part. We hope the army is prepared.
When is the last time that Israel had a ground war of this size? Have we had something like this? Is this new? And why do you think we're waiting to go in?
So, I mean, Israel has gone into Gaza before. We went in 2008, 2009. We went in 2014. Most of the time we don't go in. We just blow stuff up and then we reach a ceasefire agreement. So it has happened before, but never on this scale. The sheer number of people mobilized, I don't think, has been duplicated since 1973. We had invasions of Lebanon in 1982 and in 2006. Those were wars with an external enemy. So we did have those. So this is not the first time, but this is the first time in many years. And that Israel actually declared war. I think it's the first time since 1973. As to why the delay, there's a lot of speculation. You know, they say don't know, and those who know don't say. Part of it is the, you know, given how badly the army was caught off guard and the lack of intel that saw this, there's probably a lot of an abundance of caution of not wanting to rush into anything and make other mistakes.
Right.
A desire to really, you know, reach, we don't know what they're hitting, what they're blowing up, their infrastructure's underground, a desire to maybe reach a certain level of what they believe is destruction of the defensive infrastructure of Gaza. Mm-hmm. And there's also a certain amount of external pressure, also trying to get the civilian population down south, which is hindered by Hamas itself, that wants them to be killed because they only love putting these images up and stirring up the entire Arab world in outrage, which look what happened after the fake news about Israel blowing up the hospital, which we now know is their own missile. And that, by the way, you can see is beyond a doubt their own misfired Palestinian Islamic Jihad missile, because about a third of their missiles land in Gaza because they're such poor quality. Mm. But there's also a lot of speculation about U.S. pressure. The U.S. putting pressure, you know, Israel needs to be resupplied in terms of its bombs and a lot of its munitions and things and parts from the U.S. And the U.S. has been putting pressure on Israel to allow humanitarian aid into Gaza, which now Israel, after Biden just visited, Israel agreed, which is, again, humanitarian aid to Gaza means it goes to Hamas. There's no way of ensuring that it goes to the people.
So
Israel did not want to do that. As much as it feels sorry for the population, no other country would give its enemy that just slaughtered, you know, thousands of its own civilians humanitarian aid. Only Israel is expected to do that and criticized for not doing it.
Right.
Meanwhile, the rest of the world stands around and doesn't do too much of anything. But it could be also the most recent delay, I'm sure, is Biden was just in Israel today. There's no way that Israel is going to launch the ground offensive while Biden was still here. have to let them get out of the country.
Why is that? Just politically, it doesn't look good. It sounds like it'd be a great idea. To be honest, why would they do that?
Yeah, because it puts America too much in the front of the conflict. Sort of like where the optics of it look bad. There's been situations where America is going against it and Israel does it anyway, and then the backlash, you know, is much more extreme.
Right.
But we also got to get him out of the country too, because maybe there'll be this massive, what if Hezbollah, that's the big thing. The other, you know, the thing really, really, the big concern is what's Hezbollah going to do, which means what's Iran going to do?
Right.
And they can open up a two-front war and start shooting like over, you know, 150,000 missiles at Israel. And they have a much bigger military, bigger and better missiles and bigger and better military. So there's a lot of things going on. It wouldn't look good to have Biden in the country if Hezbollah starts to launch 100,000 missiles at Ben Gurion Airport.
That's for sure. Right.
So there's a lot of stuff going on. I think now we'll see very soon. It has to happen. I was talking to you before we talked about my son is, you know, mobilized already since 11 days ago. And he's saying that everyone's, you know, psyched to go, but they're getting real edgy and restless because they've been sitting around. Okay, they train, they got their equipment, they've been training, but you know, you just can't have hundreds of thousands of soldiers sitting around doing nothing all day long, because that's what you do in the army. You know, when you're not fighting, it's hurry up and wait. You're sitting around doing very little, and that's not healthy.
Yeah. I think it's really hard. I think it's also difficult because, you know, out here in like outside of Israel, it's really ramping up the rhetoric and the dialogue around who's right, who's wrong, what's real, what's not. It really is a truth war out here. And I think everyone in Israel is on, you know, Shpilka's kind of waiting for this to see what's going to happen. Everyone outside is also waiting, like what's happening, what's going to go on, and I think the biggest thing on people's minds right now is the hostage situation. I think, you know, there is no moral high ground whatsoever after the slaughter and murder of innocent people. And certainly there's no moral high ground to be had on the side of the Palestinians or Hamas, as long as there's hundreds of hostages that are women, children, et cetera, et cetera. But weirdly enough in the news and weirdly enough on social media, that is not the position that's being taken. And there it is just a brutal, brutal info war that's happening out here, to use a terrible term because it's really annoying. You know, it's a term that was co-opted by some people that I don't necessarily I'm on board with. But this idea that as long as we're sort of waiting to see what's going to happen with the ground offensive, everyone is in a bit of a frozen place. So it's an interesting time. What else do we need to kind of have an idea about in terms of what are we seeing? How are people doing in Israel? What's happening there in terms of navigating on the ground what is now? I'm assuming all of those towns and kibbutzim that were attacked around Gaza are pretty much empty. Where are all of those people staying that did survive? What does that look like right now?
Well, we saw a tremendous outpouring of support, and they were put in hotels, you know, obviously not at their own expense. People have them living in their houses. I know people have converted their facilities and guests, their tzimmerim, their guest cottages, to refuges for these people who are out of their homes. Some of these people's homes are completely, they've lost everything. They burned a lot of the houses to the ground. Right. So you've seen the best of Israel at this time. Whatever the outpouring and unity in the country is really, really great. But even on the home front, which again is not far from the front lines, still people are getting kind of, you know, it's the calm before the storm. When everyone got to a certain level, there was a plateau of his like real, like, you know, intense energy. And now things have sort of come down, but now we know the next phase is coming, and that's when it's going to get, because we're going to have, you know, the redux, we're going to have then casualties. And right now there's not a lot of, there's a couple of some missile hits, there's a few casualties, but it's low key stuff compared to what's going to happen next. But I think also a lot of, if you're watching the news here, you're looking at what's going on in diaspora, and you see the groundswell of massive anti-Israel sentiment around the world, and on the all the things that are going on in like university campuses in North America. People are seeing that in the news here. And it's interesting that here people aren't walking around scared you know, like I got to hide my kippah because there's some, I might get beaten up on the street. You're in the Jewish country. On that level, there's a certain level of calmness because you're in the Jewish state. This is our country. People don't do that kind of stuff here. Anyone who might think to, you know, you don't have any, the universities, I think, are basically closed now, but there wouldn't be, I don't think you'd be, you'd have too many Arabs having pro-Hamas. You know, the Israeli Arab population could be very vocal and very Palestinianized in Israel. I don't think you'd have too many of them out. Not that all of them are. Some of them are quite upset about what's going on, but there would be too many. The Israeli street would not put up with too much of that, you know. And this is our country, the majority. I think what's going on in the diaspora, and that's where you are, you know, I get the sense, and I'm watching, I get Fox News too also. I'm watching a lot of the interviews and, you know, the reporters going to campuses. And the Jews there in many ways are like, it's a double dose of unease. It's the worry about what's going on with our brothers in Israel. Mm-hmm. And it's also like the level of hostility, especially watching some of these university students crying to the deans of schools that they want to kill me. And they're painting like stars of David on people's dorm room doors and things like that. Like the Germans did in 1833. This is scary stuff also.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a very, and look, you know, we don't want to do comparative suffering or comparative danger. I think, you know, it's dangerous in different ways inside Israel and outside Israel for Jews. But I would say out here, look, I think I mentioned this to you. I have a friend who is of German and Irish origin, and he posted on his Facebook wall the other day, like, I would hide you if you need a place to go. And there's been several articles and blog posts from people saying, you know, people who aren't Jewish don't understand that this is the question that is now crossing every Jewish person's mind. Who do I know that's not Jewish that would hide me if I needed to run? And it's just a stunning shift of how we think about being in the diaspora as Jews. There's a huge sense of dissonance. It's a little bit like, God forbid, when you're in the mourning experience or grief, like if you've lost someone in your family, every interaction you have with somebody who doesn't know that that's going on or didn't know that person in your family, you always feel a little weird for a very long time afterwards because it's like you're in a altered reality and they have no idea what's going on. That is the collective experience of the Jewish people right now in the diaspora. We feel very weird and very unsafe. And really significantly starting to think like everyone's updating their passports. Everybody's making sure that if they needed to run, they could. They're asking that question, where would we go? And it's definitely, look, I'm here in Toronto. There are now wide, you know, open police presence at every significant Jewish institution. There are undercover security guards at the schools and at the shuls. We have a huge military presence at the synagogues in Ottawa. You know, there's really a sense of high alert. And it is incredibly scary and uncomfortable for people. And a lot of people that I know who are kids of survivors or have Holocaust survivors in their family are doubly or triply traumatized because they're like, I can't believe I'm seeing this again in my lifetime.
Yeah, that's actually shocking. And again, like the frog in the water analogy, we've seen a rise over the years in anti-Semitism. You know, the Holocaust kind of put anti-Semitism down for half a century, and it's been literally about 50 years, about it's been on steady increase, and now it's really peaking out. And we see that these spikes, and every time there's a war in Gaza, there's massive spikes in anti-Semitism around the world. Again, just illustrating the fact that the Israel issue is only the thin veneer over what is just anti-Semitism, hiding behind another excuse for hating Jews, but that even if I'm sure it must be very uncomfortable if you identify as a Jew, especially openly identify as a Jew, you walk around with a kippah or a mug and David on, or, you know, waving an Israeli flag. It's one thing, but it must be, I can't speak from this because it's not me and I'm not living in America or North America, but it must be really shocking for people who very minimally identify as Jews at all. And or may even, you know, be have nothing to except they're Jews in name alone, but then to realize that they're being made uncomfortable too is a very powerful wake-up call that, you know, they always say that people who don't like us don't care about our political or our religious affiliations.
Yeah.
This is a big inflection point in both Israel and America. And we're both feeling threatened, but in very different ways. The fear that I'm having is fear for my son and son-in-law going in the army, external threats, war, missiles. The fear that you guys are having is starting to look like, you know, I'm not in the, starting to look like Europe in the 1930s.
Yeah.
Certain levels. It's etic, you know, it's not like, you know, Hitler was a pretty extreme. He gets into power and he was an open anti-Semite. Governments are not changing their policy against Jews, but there's on the street, grassroots, there seems to be a lot going on from a lot of this.
And I think part of the difficulty also is the places where we feel abandoned. You know, on the university campuses, in the academic circles, absolutely Jews feel not just abandoned at this point, but unsafe. And that is across the board at most universities. And thankfully, we've started to see the donor revolt with the likes of Bill Ackerman and the Wexner Foundation pulling significant funding from significant institutions in response to that, because they've openly come out and said that they support Hamas. But, you know, also the news media here in Canada, surprisingly enough, CNN has done a fairly good job of being a balanced reporting institution. Weirdly enough, I don't know why. It's been great.
I think they have a new CEO.
Yeah, it's been, you know, it's been great. It's not 100%, but definitely much better than it's been ever before. The CBC and the BBC have been absolutely horrific in their coverage, absolutely unverified reports, taking their information directly from Hamas info agencies and reporting it as news. They have been absolutely unsupportive of their Jewish communities, and rightly so. People are starting to protest and revolt. There was a huge protest outside of the BBC just a couple days ago. So feeling really abandoned by the news media, I think, has been a big part of being Jewish in the diaspora right now. And also, you know, just trying to figure out how do we support each other and support Jews in Israel at the same time, and not feel terrible that we're not in Israel, and at the same time have empathy for our position and the fact that we're scared that our kids, God forbid, could go to school and have bomb threats or even worse.
Wow. So there's two really, you know, important things you're talking about there. One is, you know, the fear that people feel. You know, we saw this during the Holocaust. The one of the people asked, where was God during the Holocaust? I said, you have to say first, where was man? Right. And what the Holocaust really showed us is the failure of enlightened European society to truly produce a better world. We just got mechanized mass murder. And you're seeing sort of a return. You're seeing the failure, you know, like Western liberal academia, you know, the entertainment industry, the news media. This is where the elites, the intellectual elites, you know, are highly concentrated in. And we're seeing the failure of these people to be into truth and to stand up for values. And because it's being mixed with you know, this intersectional, this kind of warped way that people kind of look at the world, where anyone who's successful or victorious has to be evil or wrong or an oppressor. Right. And Israel is just kind of a micro version, the completely warped narrative of Israelis being, you know, foreign white colonialists oppressing the people of color, the indigenous people of color of the Middle East. It's one lie based on another lie, but that sort of false narrative and that crazy intersectionality, which makes the weirdest bedfellows of radical Islam and the radical left, which is so concentrated on university campuses, all unite to come after the Jewish people, is very scary, because people really feel, like you said correctly, you know, these are the places that are, you know, the West, especially America, is all about freedom of speech and, you know, and the melting pot. And look what you're getting. You're getting an incredible level of intolerance and cancel culture, and even, you know, forget the psychological pressure, even physical threats against people.
Yep.
So we're all kind of, I don't think, you know, Israelis are really hyper-focusing on what's going on in America. I think the diaspora is much more focused on Israel, because again, the point of the immediate physical threat is much more so there.
Yeah.
But even people in diaspora, I know that a lot of them are definitely feeling uncomfortable. So, and that already creates a certain level of connection that is usually not there. You know, all the Israelis who are bickering and fighting over judicial reform and the left, the liberal conservative debate in Israel was ripping the country apart. And that's kind of put on hold. I mean, I'm not in America or Canada or anywhere like that, but my intuition is there's a less internal debate and probably a lot more unity and focus that we're all in this boat together. And we have to pool our resources and protect each other because we're all, you know, whether you're in Israel and diaspora, where we all are one Jewish people, which is the silver lining of what is this kind of a scary cloud of what's going on. But I think bottom line, I think what people in diaspora have been doing has been very good. I think the prospective Israelis, I think they see the outpouring of concern, whether it's just writing to people. Like, I can't tell you how many people wrote to me and asked me, and constantly, it's every day. I have people writing me every day. It's getting a little bit much, you know, literally right. Every day. Okay, I'm okay. Right. I say when the ground war starts, you can write me again and find out how okay I'm doing. I'll be a lot more nervous again. Yeah, but the amount of support that people, you know, the amount of money and aid and everything people have been doing.
Yeah,
I think people in Israel are really, really aware and very, very appreciative of how much we really are, whether in a diaspora in Israel, we're part of one nation and we're in the same boat together.
Right. Yeah, I'll tell you some wild stories too, just as a bit of context. And then I would love to just kind of get a sense of, you know, let's drill down a little bit into, you know, our history of these types of anti-Semitism and what this looks like and where we can expect to go, I think, over the next couple of months. What can we get right that we didn't in the past? And, you know, what do we need to be careful of? In such a liminal space right now where we're at a tipping point, or as you said, an inflection point. Like, I'm sure there have been inflection points where we really messed it up and inflection points where we really did a good job. So I kind of want to go into that, but you know, I will just say in terms of it's been quite something being in the Toronto Jewish community. We had 15,000 people show up at the Israel rally last week, which was just unbelievably incredible. We booed our city mayor, who is part of who made a really inappropriate and hateful tweet at the beginning of after Hamas's attack. So there was a real unity in that, because there's a lot of very left-leaning Jews who probably would never, ever in their wildest dreams have thought that they would boo an NDP Toronto mayor. And also, I just heard from somebody the other day that the UJA here overnight, I think, raised like $9 billion to be able to help and do stuff for Israel in some way and to secure the Jewish community. So I think you're right that there's been an incredible network that's been built of people who put their boots on the ground and their money where their mouths is and have said, we need to handle this now, which is pretty incredible.
Everyone should read the book, The Pledge by Leonard Slater. I always talk about this book.
Okay.
It's about how after World War II, you know, speaking about extremes, you know, the European Jewry and what American Jewry, how everyone post-World War II put their differences aside and used incredibly in amounts of resources and genius Jewish thinking to get weapons into Israel. Wow. To make sure that the fledgling Jewish state didn't go through, you know, could survive and not repeat what happened to the Jews of Europe during the Holocaust. That's a very inspiring book. And I think you're seeing a lot of that now. And I think we're going to see kind of more of that. The difference is, I think, you know, that you're going to see, and you didn't have the anti-Semitism. As soon as the news of the Holocaust came out, you know, before World War II, there was a lot of anti-Semitism in the United States. Father Joe Coughlin of this radio show, rabid anti-Semite, you know, the Ford, you know, Henry Ford, you had restrictions on Jews and a lot, you had the Bundist and Nazi marches. And then when the war hit, the difference between then and now is good and evil was very clear. No one was marching around doing pro-Japanese rallies on December 8th, 1941 after Pearl Harbor. Here, they're because the world is a lot crazier. And the enlightened European society, enlightened American, North American society seems to have a lot less clarity about what is right and wrong and good and evil. Mm-hmm. Don't have that same kind of situation here anymore. So unlike after World War II, where Jews were really 6 million Jews dying, as you mentioned last podcast, you know, the book, you know, people like dead Jews, the world shut up about anti-Semitism. Right. You see, now what happens is, look what happens over, 1,300 Jews killed in Israel. The world doesn't even shut up for a day. or some of the world immediately starts.
Well, yeah, jumping. now it's deeply fashionable to be anti-Israel. Like, right. It's not even acceptable. It's in. It's a trend. It's fashionable. If you are on the right side of history, you need to see Israel as an apartheid colonial state. It's shocking. It's just so and the idea now that politics is fashion, right? Like, it's fashionable to be an activist. And so that whole activist culture has been completely co-opted by a narrative, which is insane, that Israel is the bad guy.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. But now we don't have the wiggle room. We don't have the same, it's not the same situation as it was, you know, 80 years ago or 75 years ago. So we're all in a much more uncomfortable place, even if we're not facing the same threat as, you know, Nazi Germany.
So where are the places where it could, where are the places where it could go wrong and the places where it could go right, both for Israel and for the diaspora right now, based on what you have seen historically, like, where, what mistakes do we need to be careful of?
Well, I mean, in Israel, the only, you know, mistakes we need to, well, obviously we have to be have a successful military campaign. We have to eliminate. Right. Hamas must be eliminated. There's no middle ground there. The only problem is, of course, is anyone who's thinking with a little forward thinking person has to realize that what's after that, what do you do?
Right.
You know, Israel does not want to reoccupy, you know, Gaza like we used to do. Will the world step up and actually finally do something? There are things you can do there. Gaza could be, with a modicum of a proper leadership or even mediocre leadership, it could be paradise between the job opportunities presented by being next to Israel and its location on the Mediterranean. And, you know, it could be like, you know, Beirut. It could really have been an amazing place. So there's a lot of potential there. The question is, we'll see what the world really does now, whether people really care, because it's very easy to yell and scream about Israel and scream for Palestinian rights and, you know, and protecting the poor innocent civilians of Gaza when they're being attacked. But when they're not being attacked, let's see what the world does. And we see the world hasn't done that much.
But is it possible in that area to have boots on the ground in terms of like peacekeeping forces, like they did, say, in Afghanistan or in Iraq? Like, would they have American or, you know, joint forces on the ground in Gaza that would somewhat mitigate that situation if they remove Hamas? Or is that an absolute no-go because it's Israel and too inflammatory?
No, again, if it's Israel, it'd be more of a problem. If other countries would step in as kind of like a Marshall Plan rebuilding, not as conquerors, but we're just going to go in and fix everything up and make sure the real terrorist cells still hanging around shooting at soldiers and things like that, then it could be possible. It could be possible but we're dealing with an entire population that has been brainwashed to hate. These are little kids who are literally raised from the age of three, four years old to sing songs about martyrs and killing Jews and playing games like Stab the Jew and stuff like that. You have no idea the level of hate that's been indoctrinated into these people. If they can wean themselves off of that. So that's going to be the big challenge, where Israel really, you know, winning the campaign, winning it as quickly as possible, minimizing civilian casualties, and then which will gain us a lot of deterrent value in the Arab world and reestablish Israel's position as a dominant strategic player, which is the main reason why countries like Saudi Arabia are interested in having a relationship with Israel. But then also being able to put something constructive into place. And I mean, you could be sure a lot of people are thinking about that one also. The other big mistake, the other thing is, you know, this has created a lot of unity. And let's just hope that in Israel, when it's over, people recognize we wake up and we don't go back into fighting and arguing over things like judicial reform. Let's hope that both sides wake up and recognize that what counts more than anything else is unity. You don't have to give up on all your principles, but you got to compromise and you got to maintain a civil discourse. So that's for sure where we could see big positive changes happening. But in the diaspora, it seems to me that this is a really powerful wake-up call for understanding Jewish identity. You know, you can, it's like gravity. You can choose to ignore it, but you're going to face the consequences if you do.
Right.
You can choose to run away from your Jewish identity, but, you know, it can chase after you even in ways you don't find so pleasant. So rather than only suddenly wake up and feel uncomfortable as a Jew, why not work to feel comfortable as a Jew? And maybe the diaspora needs to make kind of the same sort of come to the same conclusions that we do in Israel, that we're all part of one big family. And there's a lot of infighting and factionalism in the Jewish world. And to recognize that we have to make a paradigm shift in focusing on what unites us as one people and agree to disagree on things, but to take the silver lining out of this is a recognition that look at the power of the Jewish people unified. What we do is incredible. The amount of mm-hmm. of caring and aid and support that's being sent is just unbelievable. Yeah. And it's always there. Well, why do we have to be in a position of being threatened to be right. so proactive?
Right.
And unified.
Do you think, look, there's, you know, some calls that, you know, maybe this means like we're all supposed to just leave wherever we are in the diaspora and move to Israel? You know, on one hand, we can hear the spiritual context of that. On the other hand, there's also just the realities on the ground of like what that would even look like and how do we even do that? And is that really what we're all supposed to do collectively? Like, what do we do with that idea? Is that something that I fundamentally believe that that is where we're eventually supposed to end up. I fundamentally chafe, however, at the idea that we are being manipulated a little bit to think like, because we're not doing that, that's partly why this is happening. Does that make sense? Like, how do we hold this idea that, you know, are we being forced to leave the diaspora and that's why this is happening? I guess that's my question.
Yeah. So, I mean, first of all, I think it's dangerous to venture into why things are happening necessarily, right. unless because none of us are prophets. If we had a prophet, we could ask him and he would tell us. There's a kind of way of looking, there's like the hashkafic, sort of the Jewish worldview way of looking at it. And then there's the practical and okay. reality is somewhere in between there. Look, right. to say otherwise, what I'm about to say now, I'm putting my rabbi hat on is we have to appreciate that as comfortable as the diaspora might be on Bathurst and something or right. Lakewood or, you know, and Pico Robertson in LA or Northwest London, right. we are only in diaspora as a punishment. We've gotten very used to being there. And sometimes the diaspora is very comfortable, mm-hmm. but we have to recognize that there's a God who runs the world. This is the Jewish perspective. And Judaism is the Jewish people as a nation living in our national homeland, creating a unique nation that's a light to nations in a specific piece of real estate, which is the only outlet that we can plug into to actualize our potential, which means bottom line, you can't argue this point. There's no room for arguing from a traditional Jewish perspective that there is no long-term future for Jews in diaspora. Now, long-term in Judaism, we have a very long history. So we've been there for thousands of years. I've been saying this literally for decades, that God is shutting the diaspora down. He created a Jewish state in 1900, a half of 1% of the Jews in the world lived there. Today, half the Jews in the world live there. You know, in 1900, one Jew spoke Hebrew as his first language, Eliezer ben Yehuda's son, Ben Sion. He's the guy who resurrected mm-hmm. Hebrew as a spoken language and raised his son speaking it. Today, Hebrew is the first language of half the Jews in the world. That's a pretty amazing statistic when you think about how much the population of Israel's and the diaspora has largely closed down. Much of it was closed down, arguably with no choice involved with the Holocaust, literally ending a good percentage of the Jewish world's population in Europe. The right. collapse of the Soviet Union brought another million Jews from that part of the world in. From my perspective, rabbi historian perspective, is the last refuge point for Jews in the diaspora before it closes down is going to be North America. Right. I mean, there's a few places elsewhere, you know, there's a good Jewish community, but it's basically shutting down. And Europe is really uncomfortable. Like the Muslim population of France has the largest Jewish population in Europe. And it's getting real uncomfortable there.
Right.
Because there's a lot
and
of
aren't they leaving by the tens of thousands and, there
yeah,
now?
But the difference is, but there's a great, France is maybe a good case for you guys in North America to focus on. French Jews who are mostly not really French Jews. They're basically North African Jews who spoke French. So they fled to France. The ones who had money came to France. The ones who didn't, like the Moroccans, the poor Moroccans came to Israel. So the rich ones went to Montreal or to France where they could have commonality of language. But the French Jews, God has been turning up the thermostat, so to speak, in my opinion, in Europe for a long time. And the level of violence and fear that Europeans of Jews have lived in, now American, North American Jews are starting to get used to. Even, you know, what's been going on in France for decades is just only been going on in America for the last literally few years. You know, Tree of Life, stuff like that. You didn't have that ever happening in America.
Right.
And the huge upsurge in that Jews are like 2% of the population of America, but the targets of over 60% of all religious-based hate crime is pretty unbelievable statistic. So the French Jews, who, by the way, are generally speaking Sephardic and much more traditional and much more connected anyway, mm-hmm. are all buying property in Israel. Hmm. I know so many. If you go to Netanya in July, you'll think you're in Marseille. I'm not joking. Wow. Everyone, all their vacations homes And they live in a nice place. Marseille is down on the water, you know, on the other side of the Mediterranean. Right. They all got a house in Israel because some of them are saying, this is what's going through a lot of people's heads in North America. Look, for many different reasons, my kids are not the right age. I don't have a job there. You know, the housing is crazy. There's a lot of reasons not to come, but a person should always have one foot out the door, I would say. And I always tell everyone this. I said, buy a piece of real estate anywhere in Israel if you can, even if it's something you don't plan to live in, just to have a piece of real estate in Israel.
Right.
We saw during COVID that Israel closed its doors to Jews for the first time since the founding of the state. You couldn't get in for like 2 years. Right. These are realistic. We're getting a taste of things to come. It's not to panic and freak out, but not to, like I said, the biggest mistake we could all make, whether we're living in Israel or living in America, is to go back to sleep. You know, we can't go back to sleep. We have to, we're not going to be on the same level, as we say in Yiddish, of spilkas, like of nervousness. And, you know, when things calm down, they'll be, the thermostat will go down somewhat,
yeah.
But it's not going to go down to level as before. And we'd be stupid. We'd be foolish, because then we have to get a bigger scare and a bigger and bigger and bigger. And we don't want to be trying to get an emergency evacuation flight with that bag you showed me by your desk there with your emergency right. supplies, because you grabbed like a pair of underwear and your toothbrush and you ran to try and get on a flight to Israel. It's not the way to do it. Not saying it's happening anytime in the next week or so, but clearly that's what's going on. And it also involves us understanding that, you know, this is anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
And that's the other big, not just about living in Israel. It's about living as Jews. And living as Jews doesn't mean just like keeping kosher and keeping Shabbos. It's a recognition that this, like I said, Israel bashing is the final form of that anti-Semitism is hiding behind. And how do we know that's true? By the level of upsurge of anti-Semitism directed at Jews around the world who have nothing to do with Israel. It's very clearly the case.
Yeah, so rather- every pro-Hamas or pro-Palestinian rally usually ends with the cry, gas the Jews. Like, let's be really clear about that. Like, this is not about anti-Zionism as some kind of cover for social justice is quickly losing its facade and very quickly becoming, it's very clear that there's no such thing as anti-Zionist that isn't anti-Semitic and doesn't hate Jews.
Yeah, actually 100%. And the more they deny it, the more they don't believe that. Yeah. But it's also, I think it's some of the fear possibly going deep in the subconscious of Jews in diaspora. God, if Israel falls, where do I go?
Right.
You know, Jews in Europe didn't have anywhere to go. Israel's our, you know, I still tell people today, all things considered, Israel's still the safest place in the world for Jews to be. I know it sounds weird, but I honestly believe that. But we also, you know, just to like kind of do a full circle on this anti-Semitism thing. If it's anti-Semitism, we got to remember that, you know, all excuses aside, and I think I mentioned this, I don't know if I mentioned it last time, the quote from Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin from 200 years ago, he said, when Jews don't make Kiddush, Gentiles make Havdalah. And it doesn't mean literally Kiddush on Friday night versus Havdalah on Saturday night, but when we don't live and act as Jews and be the people we're supposed to be, which is this role model for the world, the chosen people have no choice. Our great-grandfather Abraham chose a responsibility for us. If we don't live up to the responsibility, which has been our job for going on 4,000 years of being the people who connected the world to God and taught the world about morality and all the values that are the foundational values of Western liberal civilization, which are largely being forgotten and disconnected from their Judeo-Christian roots. If we don't finish the job and push humanity over the finish line, humanity is going to try and finish us. So we have to, the wake up call is, you know, not just to go back to sleep and I can stay in a diaspora forever and never it's going to happen here, yada, yada, yada. But the wake up call that I can't just ignore my Jewish identity and only feel Jewish when it's uncomfortable to be Jewish. It's to feel
right,
Jewish and comfortable. Yeah.
And the caveat, let's, you know, because we did a 4-part series on the history of the Orthodox world and made very clear that, you know, that we're still trying to figure out what, you know, that Jewish identity can look many ways. Like, I don't want this to sound like we're, you know, putting out a scree that everybody should be like Haredi and religious and that there's only one way to deeply connect to your Jewish identity. I just think that, you know, this idea of what you're saying is turning towards yourself as a Jew and understanding what that means for you, your own deep connection with that idea and identity and how that relates to how you relate to yourself, how you relate to other people, and how you relate to God, that those are our relationship challenges to try to sort out. And that we're not necessarily, I mean, look, both you and I are observant Jews. Like, you know, we're not saying that it needs to be one way, but that it needs to be some way is, right. is I think what we're saying.
100. Yeah, you nailed it. Absolutely. It's like, don't just feel Jewish. Like that line I think I mentioned last time when Tevye and Fiddle on the Roof says, God, you chose us. Couldn't you choose someone else? Mm-hmm. Like we're only chosen to be picked on. Have a positive Jewish identity. I always use the analogy of the ladder. We're all on the same ladder. We're on different rungs of the ladder. Just because, by the way, I've said this many times, a person may look religious and doesn't mean they're necessarily a holy person. There are people who are not religious who are very holy, good people. Like, it's not right. A matter of your externals, but of it's course. A matter of living and learning. Whatever rung of the ladder you're on, you got to commit. This is what you want to do now. Because we believe also on the highest level that everything physical going on in the world is a manifestation on some level of our relationship with God. And if we improve that relationship with each other as Jews and human beings, and we improve our relationship with God, we spend some of our time developing that relationship with us, which is all of what Torah is about. It's not about doing something for God. He doesn't need us to pray for him or keep kosher or anything like that. But whatever we're doing, living, learning, any level we're on of doing something that gives us a constant on some level, ideally daily connection to our Jewish identity and yeah. gives us something positive to see the beauty and the value of Judaism, not just the chosen people chosen to be bashed forever by non-Jews wherever we go, but the chosen people who have brought the world so much beauty, so much morality, so much spirituality, so much positive things, this teeny tiny nation that's transformed the world, to have some Jewish pride, some Jewish proactivity, And to be doing something, anything, you know, to be learning, to live and learn more and bring the whatever aspects of Judaism you relate to that enhance your life spiritually and physically and your family relationships and community relationships, to bring those things into little steps, baby steps. Yeah. Trust me, if we're all doing that, we would see the thermostat of anti-Semitism would turn down a lot. So it's kind of like, Ellie, it's kind of like there's two things going on. There's the national thing about Israel. Yeah. You know, start developing at least a love for Israel and have the picture on your wall, the place I'd love to be at some point. I don't know when I'm going to make it there, but also my Jewish identity as a central feature of my life and not just something that I'm forced into identifying with when I'm being attacked. Or a couple times a year, I go to synagogue and do the few Jewish cultural things because they're warm and fuzzy and my grandparents did them. And I think if we would all do that, we would see a big changes internally within the Jewish world and externally in how the world treats us, because a lot of people actually like Jews, a lot of non-Jews who really like Jews who are Jewish.
And yeah, I think it's also so counterintuitive, right? It's like leaning into the thing that makes you the most uncomfortable, right? Like this idea of like, look, if you're a Jew and you're being attacked for being Jewish, you would think you would just run from being Jewish. Like, oh, this thing makes me unsafe. I'm going to run away from that. But what you're saying is so counterintuitive, but speaks to, like you said, a supernatural paradigm, which is no, it's the very thing. Like if you lean into your Judaism, the level of unsafety will be reduced, not increased. But it's a very difficult thing to wrap your head around. And it's also very difficult because you don't want to feel like you're to blame for the reason that anti-Semitism is happening. And that's not what we're saying. We're just saying, here's one of the ways the system works. And we know we all, when we're afraid, want to run away from that thing that we're afraid of. But it's actually connecting with our Judaism in the face of anti-Semitism is more important than ever. So it's a very counterintuitive thing, but I think what you're saying is it's a historical pattern that we see. If Jews run from their Judaism, it doesn't make them safer.
Exactly. And I say Jews for Judaism make amazing role models for the world. And, you know, one of the, you know, the supernatural aspects, even a negative way of being Jewish in Israel, is the hyper-focus the world has, this crazy double standard we're seeing that's applied to Israel that goes out of its way to minimize civilian casualties, et cetera. And it's unfair and hypocritical. It is the fact that the UN has passed more resolutions condemning Israel than every other country in the world combined in the last 50 years. If what we understand about our role in history is true, that's the way it has to be. We're never really going to be treated like anyone else because we are very unique and special people in terms of our role in human history and what we're supposed to be accomplishing. This is what we understand about ourselves. It's not about feeling superior to people. It's a matter of feeling a unique level of responsibility that history has proven that we have.
Right. Like we talked about this in the Orthodox one, like we're one of the superheroes in the team of superheroes that are supposed to push the world towards its best outcome, but we have our very particular superpowers and our very particular role in this, you know, in this experience. So to run away from our role and run away from our powers doesn't mean that the threat will disappear. We have to, in fact, turn towards it in some way, exactly. Even when it's scary.
Like I say, being Jewish might not be always comfortable, but it's always meaningful. And right. The trick is to not relate, not just to when it's uncomfortable, start realizing you're Jewish, but to, you know, when it is quieter in Israel and in diaspora, to really delve more deeply into who we are and what our mission is and the power of the Jewish people to be an incredibly positive, transformative force and role model for the human race, which God knows when we look at the world today and the situation we're in, the world definitely needs the values and the role model that we can be providing if we understand who we are and what we represent.
Amen. Okay. So I think we'll wrap it up there for today. Let's, God willing, if we can do another one next week. I know that you're traveling, but hopefully we can find maybe a way to figure out the timing and the schedules. Please, anyone listening, if you have questions, if you have feedback, if you want us to talk about something in particular, if you have a story you think we should hear, please go ahead and get in touch with us. All of our information is in the liner notes. We would love to hear from you. Thank you everyone for listening and for being a part of this ongoing conversation that we're having. Rabbi Spiro, anything to end up with?
No, we should just hope that things end quickly and decisively and our boys should come home safe, and we should have some peace in the Middle East, not just for us, but for all the neighbors around us, and benefit from a much stable, more stable and peaceful world, especially in this part of the world.
Amen. Amen. Thanks everyone for joining us.
Thanks for joining us on Remember What's Next. If you would like to get more resources and information about Rabbi Ken Spiro, please check out his website at www.kenspiro.com. If you have a question or an idea for a topic, please email us at rememberwhatsnext@gmail.com.